This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue or two from my comic book collection, which I will select sort of at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Were the issues worth 25 cents? Were they bargains at 25 cents? Or were they still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 88th episode of the Quarter Bin, we're looking at Dr. Fate 3 and 4, cover dated September and October 1987. But first, a little feedback. On episode 86, Wonder Woman Retroactive, I heard from Supergirl's favorite ER doctor, Dr. Ange. Thanks for the great review of the Wonder Woman Retroactive. As a quasi-fan of the white jumpsuit era, I don't mind the occasional peek back. It seems almost every era since then has had an issue or two where Diana dons some version of it. I can remember her wearing something like that as an agent with Steve Trevor in the Simone Dodson era. And that Catwoman costume is too delicious to hate on so much, although much of my love for it probably comes from how the mask is similar to Jean Grey's wonky yellow mask look as Marvel Girl. Anything that reminds me of Jean Grey is a good thing. That's reasonable, Ange. That's reasonable. As for retroactive reviews moving forward, I would like to hear more. As someone who grew up reading comics in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, I don't mind these attempted trips down nostalgia lane. I will admit, I've only read the Superman ones, but in particular found the Superman 1980s to be a fascinating read. The original story is just a pre-crisis tale with Superman having to face his greatest fears, one of which is losing Kara. For me, I find it interesting to read recent comics by Marv Wolfman where he seems to be either apologizing or atoning for killing off Supergirl. This story and the convergence Adventures of Superman both read like maybe, just maybe, Marv actually regrets killing off Kara. The other Superman issues were okay, but as a fan, it was kind of fun to see the mulleted Superman take on the red tresses of Lex. Anyway, thanks for the episode, Ange. Mullet, Doctor? Mullet? From what I understand, them's is fightin' words. And thinking about these retroactive titles, I think I'm as interested maybe more in the reprint stories as I am in the new retroactive stuff. There are plenty of examples throughout comics history of creative teams revisiting a title years after leaving. And often, the second time around, they've lost some of that magic, you know? So it is kind of odd to have an entire event dedicated to that proposition. Although I guess the chance, as Ange pointed out, to atone for a past mistake, that might redeem it. So thanks for making me think about it in that way, Doc. And the irredeemable Shag from the Fire and Water Podcast Network wrote in, saying that he is not a fan of Bronze Age DC, especially the main Trinity titles. The more offbeat characters are more my speed from the Bronze Age. Probably not a popular opinion, but there it is. He then talked about the way I described that Denny O'Neil lead, and he said it reminded him of the failings of many Bronze Age stories. So I can't help but wonder if Denny did that on purpose. Maybe he was just aping the more lackluster Bronze Age tales. Just a thought. Another great episode, Shag. I thought about this comment for a while. You know, I wouldn't put meta past O'Neill, but I don't think that he's self-aware or certainly self-critical enough to make fun of himself. So I don't know that he did that purposely. I can't see him purposely failing on that key of story level. But I do like your positive, optimistic approach, Shag. Martin Gregg of the Legion of Super Bloggers commented on Catwoman's costume and Diana's powers. Professor Allen, did you like that Wonder Woman 201 Catwoman costume less than the green number in Batman 197? The first new story in the Wonder Woman retroactive is just awful. It read more like a poor Robert Kaniger riff than Mr. O'Neill himself. Man, I wish I'd said that clearly, Martin. That is so right. You nailed it. Martin said he always thought it was a shame that when she got her powers back, Diana didn't have her karate skills at super level. Now that would have completely rocked again. Thanks for those comments, Martin. It's nice to hear from you, especially when you're not disagreeing with everything I say. That's a Short Box Showcase reference. And next up, because he really loves hearing his name said on podcasts, Shag also wrote in more generally on the retroactive books. In regards to more retroactive comics, I recall these being pretty good. Batman 90s, Flash 80s and 90, JLI 90s, of course Shag would say that, and Green Lanterns 90. The JLA 80 was okay, I love Jerry Conway, but it went too far to establish a meta nod to a future creator. And lots of you lovely listeners had things to say about this Dr. Fate miniseries, which we started covering last episode, episode 87. Even the preview post in Facebook garnered comments. From Sean Ross, this is an awesome mini. Giffen is in full 9-panel grid overload, though, and people's faces are long. Sean added that he loves Giffen with an inker that holds him in check a bit. He's a lot like Chris Bacalo, though. When he's restrained, he's one of the greats. When he isn't, it's hard to tell what's happening on the page. Matt Ev's comment on Giffen's art was swoon. And because he really, really likes hearing his name spoken on podcasts, the irredeemable Shag wrote in on my covering of these issues at all. Specifically, the nature of our interaction regarding these issues. Dr. Fate 1 and 2 from 1987, didn't I buy those for you and then recommended against covering them on the show? I seem to recall using the word impenetrable. I believe you also bought the 2000s Dr. Fate mini with Hector Hall / Dr. Fate, suggesting you read that one instead for the show. But do you listen to me? No. No, I don't listen to you. On the actual podcast itself, Daniel Butcher commented that he appreciated my State of Cheap Comics address. And I did seek out Ed Moore's opinion on this miniseries. Ed hosts the excellent Dr. Fate podcast, The Lords of Order. He commented that since this is the first series to bear Dr. Fate's name, it does stand out as a high point. The writing was good, very dark and mystical. The art will always be a sore point for me, as at this point in his career, I was absolutely not a fan of Giffen's art. It added to the story, I guess, but still, yuck. Much of the commentary on the issues did in fact revolve around Keith Giffen's art. Dr. Ange, from the Supergirl blog, Comic Box Commentary, said that he always liked Giffen's take on Fate. His visuals are what make these issues. The story is a bit inscrutable. You should read his Flash backups from before. And I was a Flash subscriber in that era, so I did read those Fate stories, but I don't have strong memories of them. But they were certainly the first place I ran across Dr. Fate. Mark, from I'm the Gun, commented that this was a Dr. Fate story of a different color. I admire Giffen DeMatteis' attempt at pushing for an evolution of the character. In terms of my lacking of artistic language, Mark added, I think you used good art words describing Giffen's style at the time. The only term I'd add would be abstract. Yes, Mark, abstract is good. I may well use that later in the episode. We heard from the Twitter account for Comics in the Golden Age, so I don't know if that's Chris or Mike, but whoever it was said that it was a great episode and that he had mixed feelings about the miniseries. Thanks, guys. And listeners, if you aren't listening to Comics in the Golden Age, you should be. I mean, not right now. Finish listening to this episode first. And our new friend Laurel from Twitter said that she had trouble getting up that morning, but the new Quarterbin episode with that happy yellow logo helped. Aw, that's nice. That episode was shared on Facebook by Ed Moore, Clinton Robinson, and I was Joe Crawford. I don't know that I've mentioned Joe's Tumblr enough, or maybe ever, but check out his work at For the Non-Discerning Reader at flairjoe.tumblr.com. The episode was retweeted by Laurel, the Sutherlands, Mario, Pat from the Long Box Crusade podcast, the Nexus of All Realities podcast, Noel Thingvall from the new Tarzan podcast, Greystoked, he claimed they didn't come up with the name first, I'm not sure I believe him. My theory was they realized Greystoked was a great name for a Tarzan podcast, and then realized, we have to do a Tarzan podcast. And Noel does not believe in making audio trailers or promos, but still, you should check out that podcast. Thanks for all that feedback and support, guys. I really appreciate it. We're going to take a break here, and when we come back, it's Dr. Fate number 3 and 4.
Hello, I'm Mark Sweeney, and I record a group of comics fan podcast features under the name I'm the Gun. I have been asked so many times about such a ridiculous sounding name. Scratch that. Someone once asked me about such a ridiculous sounding name and where it came from. Well, I'll answer that right here. I'm the Gun was the catchphrase, the battle cry, the mantra of an obscure DC Comics war hero introduced back in the mid-1960s, Steve Savage the Balloon Buster. Steve Savage was the first subject of On the Gun when I began it as a blog back in 2014, and Savage is a great example of the kind of story, the kind of character I like to cover on the show. I'm the Gun lives in the third string, the fourth string. I love the C-listers and the D-listers, and in the age of the trade and the omnibus, hope to champion the underappreciated and the uncollected. And I do this on features like ITG's ABCs, in which I look at shorts found in anthology titles and in backup stories. Shanna Showcase, in which I index the significant solo appearances of Marvel Comics' greatest jungle queen, Shanna the She-Devil. Reboot Review, where I'm looking at least at the time of this recording, the criminally uncollected adventures of the post-Zero Hour Legion of Superheroes. And Where's the Trade, in which I ask the rhetorical, titular question and shine a light on some favorite run or title that has yet to be reprinted. Along the way, other odds and ends may find their way into the feed, so if this sounds at all interesting to you, I encourage you to check the show out on iTunes, on Google Play, or at its home on the blog, imthegun.blogspot.com. That's I'm the Gun, the comics podcast named after the most famous catchphrase or battle cry in comics. After Up, Up, and Away, and Avengers Assemble, and Shazam, Suffering Sappho, Got Long Live the Legion, of course there's Hawkeye, and Flame On, and It's Clobbering Time, Excelsior, and Brightest Day, and Blackest Night, Hulk Smash.
And we're back. Like I did last episode, because these issues flow so closely from one right into the other, we're going to summarize both of these issues here, and then analyze both of them together later. Dr. Fate 3 and 4 each had cover prices of $1.50, meaning I acquired each of these books at a not too shabby 83% discount. The cover of issue 3 by Keith Giffen shows the Lord of Chaos Typhon close up on his face, his big ugly mouth open, his big ugly teeth showing. And inside his big ugly mouth are other ugly demons with big ugly mouths and big ugly teeth. But these three are dressed as Batman, Martian Manhunter, and Mr. Miracle. So I'm intrigued. The story, Strangers, was written, of course, by J.M. DeMatteis with art by Keith Giffen and Dave Hunt. We start with Dr. Benjamin Stoner in the Dr. Fate costume. I smell death, decay, fear, lunacy. I hear the chattering of insects. The bedbugs are swarming across the world, and that makes me very, very happy. He has the power of a Lord of Order, but doesn't serve the Lords of Order. Order is a lie. I serve Typhon, God of Chaos, God of Maggots, God of Enlightenment. He has come to understand that in the eternal war between Chaos and Order, Chaos is winning. We see the effects of these victories of Chaos. A newspaper headline proclaims snipers. We see wars and rumors of wars. And when the first burn across the planet, when the maggots feast upon each other, you'll thank me. I'm your kindly Dr. Fate, you crazy little bedbugs. But the forces of Chaos can't do their work across the Earth without someone noticing. And some Justice Leaguers have noticed. Guy Gardner, Scott Free, and John Johns are talking about the crazy week they've witnessed. Guy sums it up in his own unique way. Far as this Green Lantern can see, fellas, the world's a hellhole. Best the Justice League can do is hold back the fire a little. Keep the crowds in line. Batman pops out of the shadows, and Guy wants to know why their fearless leader called them together. Did Robin tell you you have to sleep on the couch again tonight? But it wasn't Batman who called them together. They wonder if maybe it's Dr. Fate. Not Fate, the ominous voice says. Unfortunately, he's the problem. A problem that requires the attention of the Phantom Stranger. Back in Salem over in Fate Tower, Linda Strauss and Kent Nelson are fighting over who is to blame for all of this. She blames him. My whole life has been turned inside out because of you. Well, he passes the buck on to Naboo. You don't understand. I never had a choice. After some intense flashing back to his childhood, Kent yells out to Naboo, and they have a conversation of sorts. Kent wants to die. Let me go to my wife now. But Naboo still wants to fight the war with chaos. And then Eric Strauss enters the room. We can't let chaos win. Kent, you know better than I do. And Naboo is pleased. Dr. Stoner slash Fate lands among the assembled Justice Leaguers. Typhon had not considered the super beings. Why are they here on Earth? Why are there so many of them? Fate power blasts Guy Gardner and Batman into oblivion. Except that the telepathic Martian Manhunter didn't feel them die. Phantom Stranger explains that Typhon didn't kill them, it merely sent them back. He then mysteriously explains that his mysterious plan was not for them to fight Fate, but merely to plant a seed. The war between order and chaos works on many levels, Mr. Miracle. You belong on your level, and I belong on mine. They disappear, leaving the Stranger and Fate to battle. And the Stranger attacks first, with words. He says, I love you. Kent Nelson tries to talk Eric out of fighting with Naboo, but Linda appears to hug her stepson. Naboo does not like this, saying that order can succeed, but only if the woman leaves. But Kent refuses to boot her out. If you want my cooperation, he tells Naboo, she's staying. We return to the Phantom Stranger slash Typhon Fate Stoner fight. He doesn't want the Stranger's love. They talk about Stoner's inherent compassion and whether Typhon can ever truly control him. Typhon tells him that he needs to rid himself of his caring. Caring is a sickness. Give the Stranger your compassion, your love, your suffering. Be free of it and embrace chaos. Dr. Fate seems to destroy the Stranger. But as he does his end zone victory dance, three figures approach. Kent Nelson in the lead. Call me death. Call me life. Call me man. And more than man. Call me fate. The cover of issue 4, again by Giffen, shows Dr. Fate centered against a starfield, cape hanging dramatically, mystical energies crackling around him. The story, Incarnations, was again written by J.M. DeMatteis, with art again by Keith Giffen and Dave Hunt. We start in Egypt, where civilization began over 5,000 years ago, and where it's likely to end tonight. Benjamin Stoner is the man who just might end it. He was a good man, but compassion bled him dry, and chaos seduced him. He was Stoner before. Now he's Dr. Fate, with Typhon, the Lord of Chaos, inside him. Instead of Naboo's chosen successor, Eric Strauss, it's Stoner who wears the helmet and amulet of fate. Stoner who dances through the night sky and sings. To famine, to war, to disease he sings, and the whole world will hear. Our three heroes meet this Dr. Fate, telling him that it's over. But Stoner is not impressed. Nice to see you again. How interesting that you can still put words together in coherent form after all we put you through. What you put me through only made me stronger. And don't call me Eric. Call me Fate. But Stoner he is still not impressed, mocking his comrades as a weary, wasted man and a weak, confused woman. And you, a 10-year-old in a man's body. Stoner pours madness out over Eric like he did at Arkham Asylum. But breaking his mind back then gave him the chance to rebuild it. A stronger mind, more centered, more resilient. Nabu and Kent Nelson have another conversation, and Kent relents to Nabu's pleading. Like the good soldier I've always been, I obey. Much of Nabu's power is tied up in the amulet and the helmet, but there is enough to keep Nelson's half-dead body going. And Nelson's body reforms. Flesh and spirit unite. Sacred union, yin and yang. Darkness and light. Woman and man. In a flash, Nelson finally understands the truth that Nabu has kept hidden for centuries. You can stop Stoner. The helmet and amulet are your birthright. Yours, Eric. And yours, Linda. You can do it together. You were meant to do it, just as Inza and I were. Well, Mr. Nelson, maybe not the exact same way. You and Inza were married. And Eric and Linda are stepmother and stepson, so it's actually a little bit different. Typhon sends a killing blast towards Eric, but he survives. Because Linda is near. Her presence is sustaining him. But Linda's confused. What I'm thinking, Kent, what I'm feeling, is it true? But Nabu is the one who doesn't want Linda to merge with Eric. But Kent finally convinces him to allow it. Do you crave control that much? Nabu drops the barrier, and Linda is transformed into pure energy, as it was intended from the dawn of time. Not one person, but two, coming together to meet their fate. Kent understands now that Nabu was never meant to control, but to impart knowledge to the two, to release the power inherent within them. And he is angry that Nabu stole this role from Inza. They were intended to merge together to become fate. But Eric and Linda won't be robbed of that opportunity. And in their merging, the helmet and amulet are back with the Strausses. And Typhon surrenders. For now, he says. Only for now. And Dr. Stoner's body is released, and it dissolves in mist and blood. They all head back to Fate Tower. The Strausses know what Ken is thinking and tell him not to do it. We need you. But that's not true. Kent Nelson calls out to Nabu to let him go. And Nabu lets him go. In the realm of the Lords of Order, Nabu has some serious chit-chat with his comrades. They are not too happy with him, and the feelings are mutual. He says he has to return to Earth, to the Strausses. But if he does, he can never return. The Strausses have left the tower for New York. This is our home, where you grew up. Eric reminds his stepmom that he's really only 12, but she replies with the same logic that predators often use. No, you're wrong. You've always been grown up, an old soul in a very young body. Then she says a few even more creepy things, but those are fortunately interrupted by Kent Nelson arriving at their door. Well, it's actually Nabu in Kent's body. Kent's dead body. Nabu claims he's not there to control them. He's not going to do that anymore. He's there to help. The end.
Hey, Gene, we should do a podcast.
Sounds like a great idea, Jeff, but what will we talk about?
How about a superhero that we both love?
Perfect. Someone like Thor or Captain America?
Both great choices, but I think they're being covered by somebody else already.
Wait, I've got it. What about the Protector of the Universe?
Like Voltron?
No. The guy with the jewelry that lets him create whatever he wants.
Ah, Green Lantern, nice.
Close. No, this guy has cosmic awareness.
Captain Marvel?
Almost. I mean... Quasar!
Ah, Quasar. Who doesn't love a good Quasar?
Tune in to the Quantum Cast, covering all things Quasar.
Yes, that's right. You can find us at quantumbands.blogspot.com.
And on the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network.
And we're back again. Let me start with the two concerns I had going into these issues, which I talked about last episode. First, I knew that Kent Nelson was going to die, and I was concerned that maybe he would not be given a proper exit. He'd been Dr. Fate for 45 years of comic books, and some respect was warranted. So I was worried about the nature of the send-off he would get, and I'm pretty satisfied with his exit. It was all about Inza, wanting to be with Inza. And Nabu just let him go. So that was an intense moment, but I think it was earned. Now, to some extent, the power of his death was canceled out by Nabu inhabiting his body just a few pages later, but again, I was worried about how that would be handled, and it worked out fine. Second, I had heard about the weirdness, the creepiness of the Strausses' relationship with each other. And in that area, my fears were sort of realized, especially that passage that I pointed out about Linda trying to convince Eric that he was not, in fact, a 12-year-old boy in a man's body. And I do wonder how this would be handled now, almost 30 years later. This issue was out a good 2 or 3 years before Woody Allen's relationship with his wife's adopted daughter, Sun Yi, became public. So it's not that these guys were referencing that, and I don't know if that makes it better or worse. And back to that specific comment from Linda. This is the exact logic that predators make, and that sometimes judges use in dismissing sexual abuse or rape cases. There was a case in Montana in 2013 that you may remember because of the outrage and the protests that it caused, where a judge sentenced a teacher to only 30 days in prison for raping a 14-year-old student. The judge's logic was that the girl was, quote, older than her chronological age, unquote. Obviously, again, this Dr. Fate story was written decades before this case, and I do assume that the story would take a different approach if it were written today. I believe this was around the same time that Aricia aged herself in the Green Lantern books, so she and Hal Jordan could date. And again, I assume that that story would also be changed if it were retold nowadays. The other big issue in these issues, as discussed during the feedback section, is the art. Keith Giffen's work here is divisive, controversial. It elicits strong feelings, both of the negative and positive varieties. I want to start with the covers. And I really liked these. They really do stand out among comic book covers. And that's because Giffen chooses to totally center the main figure. And in 3 of the 4 cases, basically do a symmetrical cover. The cover of issue 1 is not quite there. The cover's just a bit asymmetrical. And maybe that's because he's working around a pair of caption circles. But the main cover designs for 2, 3, and 4 are quite symmetrical, with a single large image dominating the page. It's a very unusual approach, and it makes these covers totally stand out. Those works are excellent. And I'll make pretty much the same comment on the interior art in these 2 issues that I made about the first 2 issues. And that is that there are some terrific individual panels inside these issues, inside all 4 of them. Like the covers, Giffen seems to be pouring himself into these pages. But they don't always succeed as comic pages designed to aid in storytelling. This is a challenging read because of the topic, the headiness of the concepts, the density of DeMatteis's prose, of his writing. And Giffen's pencils are impressive, they're artistic, and in some cases lovely. But they don't always help in easing the reading experience. So in terms of whether you like the art in this series, I think that's really based on what you want out of your comic book art. I totally understand people loving this art, going gaga over it. And I totally understand people hating it. And I guess I understand people landing anywhere on the spectrum between those two extremes. I do want to take a big picture view of the series at this point. As I was making it through issue 3, I was reminded of the Adam Strange miniseries from 1990. That's the prestige format three-parter, The Man of Two Worlds, which was covered here back in the early days of the show, episodes 15, 18, and 21, respectively. This was the dawn of the post-crisis era, when DC was rebooting every property they had, it seemed. Man of Steel was 1986, Batman Year One was 87, Prez's Wonder Woman was 87, this Dr. Fate mini was 87, and it led into a new ongoing in 88. And like this Dr. Fate story, the Adam Strange mini was about giving a total status quo change to a long-standing character. This one, the Dr. Fate one, was not quite as grittied up as the Adam Strange take was, but it was definitely a more mature take on, in this case, a Golden Age character, in that case, a Silver Age character. This series killed Kent Nelson. That series killed Alana Strange. The details of the Adam Strange mini, sort of the end result, the new status quo, was quickly retconned. And some of the more traditional, long-standing aspects of Adam Strange were returned to the character. While Dr. Fate has gone through some different incarnations in the time since this mini, he has been a more prominent member of the DCU than my main man, Adam Strange, has been. And even though the Strausses weren't the most recent occupants of the blue and gold suit, the idea of new incarnations of Dr. Fate, I think, started here. So I have to admit that in a strict technical sense, this one, the Dr. Fate mini, was clearly more successful in updating and changing the character than that Adam Strange one was. One note I wanted to make sure I said, a positive for the storytelling, was that issue 3 included some members of the JLA. It's a common trope in comic books and comic book TV shows and comic book movies that we sometimes wonder where the big guns are when the world is at risk in another book. But DeMatteis answers that question before we really even have a chance to ask it. Only a few pages pass between Typhon beginning his full-fledged attack on Order and the JLA noticing that something weird is going on. So bringing in Guy and Batman and John and Mr. Miracle, that was a nice touch. Just by addressing the inclusion of the greater DCU was a great writing choice. And since this is a book, a story, with an otherworldly feel, with otherworldly characters, an appearance by the Phantom Stranger is perfectly in line. The fight between the Stranger and Typhon, I think, was on some spiritual plane, but I wasn't totally sure about that. Like a lot of things in these issues, it was a little hard to follow. And I'm not sure about the Stranger's idea of fighting Typhon with the power of love. I'm not sure that plot point was developed. I like the theory. And I'll be honest, reading this in the holiday season, a spiritual victory based in love, that resonated with me. But like I said, I don't know that this was explored or certainly resolved in the issues. With a series like this, I totally acknowledge that I may have missed it. I'm sure that there are plenty of things in this mini that went right over my head. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I'm just saying. The verdict on Dr. Fate 3 and 4. In general, I'm not always in love with the darkening up of heroes or bold new takes on long-standing characters. So this series faced an uphill climb in terms of me being a fan of it. But all that being said, this is a series that is bold, dramatic, ambitious. And with the exception of the creepy part, and I'll admit, you may not be able to excuse that. It worked for me a lot more than it didn't work for me. The scripting is melodramatic and over the top, and the artwork is strange and unsettling. But if you find these cheap, go ahead and take a chance. These are definite quarter bin deals. that wraps up my coverage of Dr. Fate 3 and 4, bringing episode 88 of the Quarterbin podcast to a close. In episode 89, we're taking a little break from the Tom Harris selected issues, because 89 ends with a 9. And when an episode ends with a 9, we have an appointment with a different doctor in the year 2099. So next episode, it's Doom 2099, issues 11, 12, and 13. If you have any questions or comments about these issues, the miniseries, this episode, Dr. Fate, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the Quarterbin. The Quarterbin podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening. Professor!